Expecting heavy downpours all day today.
You're a builder. You build. It's literally in your job title.
Woo! Let's hit it.
A little rain isn't stopping you. Not today, not any day. Shouldn't your flashing tape be working through it all too? Only Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape's high-performance acrylic adhesive sticks, re-sticks, and stays stuck, even on the roughest surfaces in rain, snow, heat, and more. So you stay in control when it matters most. Show weather who's boss with Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
What is the address to your emergency?
I'm a McKenney. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Let's talk about today's case. I mean, my God, you heard that phone call. It is absolutely harrowing to imagine that there is a woman in a scenario that is so gravely dangerous. And bear in mind, at the point that she is making that phone call to the emergency helpline, she has no idea just how much in danger her life is. She cannot compute or have any understanding of how grave her situation truly is. So this all begins to play out on the 13th of September 2016. It was 6:47 a.m. in Ashland County when 911 dispatch center in Northeast Ohio received that horrific 911 call. That voice so quiet that it can almost hardly be heard through the phone. The fact that she's obviously terrified. The fact that her kidnapper is still in situ. And even though she's freed herself from her restraints, she's clearly terrified to even imagine moving. She's afraid he's going to hear her. He's going to catch her. And she says he's strong. He's got a taser. He's armed. It is so tense listening to that phone call. When I went through it, I felt my stomach churning. We've got a woman who's been abducted. We've got a woman who's also trying to get help. And you have this frustration even that this dispatcher is asking a ton of questions, even though she's made it very clear that this man who has abducted her, who's a danger to her, who has hurt her, is close by and is armed. You kind of think to yourself, why are they not just hurrying up and getting those people out there? I appreciate the need to get descriptions. I appreciate the need to get her made safe. But every time she speaks, is a potential that this killer is going to wake up. And I'm using the term killer because that's exactly who this individual is going to turn out to be.
Where's he at now? Asleep. Where's he sleeping at?
In the bedroom.
In what bedroom?
There's two houses right by the laundry street. And it's in one of those houses.
But you're at the laundromat?
No, I'm in the bedroom with them.
Does he have a weapon?
He's got a taser.
What does he look like? Is he a white male or a black male? Is he like 6 foot or is he shorter than that?
He's like 6'1", 6'2".
Do you know how much he weighs?
Probably 175.
Are you injured?
A little.
What color is his hair?
Brown.
Do you know what color his eyes are? What's he wearing?
Nothing right now.
She's terrified. Somehow, during that tense conversation with the dispatcher, she retains composure. She gives the details about her captor. She tells the name and she talks very eloquently about her situation. She's clearly not under the influence of drugs or alcohol. She's absolutely terrified. And finally, When the police arrive and she realizes that she's actually going to be safe, she makes the move and she alerts the police that she is in fact there. When she was asked on the phone about who is responsible for her abduction, she quietly said the words, Sean Great. Who is Sean Great? Well, when you look at his history, there are a lot of red flags. But one of the things that he's been considered in the press is quite a charmer. I am probably going to disagree with some of those sentiments based on what I understand about his background. But let's talk about the perpetrator in this case. He was born on August the 8th, 1976. He was born in Marion. He's the son of Teresa McFarland and Terry Great. His parents actually divorced in 1982, and his mother actually gave up custody of Sean and his older brother, Ronald, to her ex-husband. But he did stay residing with his mother for a period of time. I would say, from what I can turn up in the research, that it was relatively neglectful in that environment. In fact, he was left often in the care of his half-sister, who was young and shouldn't have had to take responsibility for bringing him up. He also struggled with certain learning disabilities, and he actually was an individual who started fires as a child. So if we think about the McDonald triad, that's where we expect to see fire starting as one element of that triad, and that means that there is a propensity for future violent behaviour that exists there. We're seeing that early in his childhood. Also, the learning disabilities did cause him issues in school. So he did have problems both behaviourally and educationally, and he was held back for kindergarten and for the first grade of his education. Ultimately, I think that we can all remember being young children, and at my school, we had tables, and those tables were called cute names. So Skywalker, for example, or Obi-Wan Kenobi, but really we all knew exactly which table depicted which level of learning. I mean, kids are whip smart, even when they're really young. You know who the bright kids are, and you know who the kids are who are struggling, and you know where you are. I was distinctly average, shall we say, throughout all of those table gradings. But I know that even as a young child, I was really aware of a sense of shame when things went wrong. I think a lot of us can relate to that. So if you've been kept down, first of all, the peers that you are around will be markedly younger to you. Because developmentally, if you're a year or 2 years ahead of the kids in your class, you feel so much more grown. And he's a tall guy. I imagine he would have been a tall child. So that's going to make him feel intrinsically different. And it's potentially going to raise that level of feeling shame within his psyche and emotional vocabulary early on. So there are problems. And those problems, I would say, get worse when he's 11 years of age. And the reason for that is his mother, who he is living with, even though custody is with his father, she actually abandons the family. She goes to live with a man in Kentucky. He's really upset by this because he doesn't like the guy that she's hanging out with. And so he ends up living with his father for the next 4 years. He attended River Valley High School. He wasn't academic at all. He struggled in lots of different ways in school, but he absolutely excelled in baseball. This was somewhere that he was stand out. And you can imagine when you're passionate about a sport and it's a place where you're visible in a place where in other areas you're altogether invisible, it's going to really matter to you because it gives you a level of reputation. It makes people feel attracted to you. You fit in because you're somebody that's doing well in sport. We all know that sportsmen often have a direct in with the popular groups in school because they are individuals who are given acclaim for their standing in that sport. But when he's 17, he basically loses that sport altogether from his life. He has an injury, it sidelines him from the sport, he never plays it again because he breaks his arm and it required surgery following the discovery of a tumour. So now, the one thing that mattered to him, the one place that he really was excelling, it's been taken. And that apparently caused a huge psychological hit. And it was a massive change in his behaviour. So after he lost his baseball passion and opportunity, he apparently got into drugs and he started running with people that were not very good for him. And again, if we're looking at fractures in the foundations of human beings, anything that you put into your body before the age of 25 is going to impact on your brain because your brain is still
Love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Developing. So for most of us, we can put recreational drugs into our system, we can drink, and it won't necessarily do that much damage in the long term. As long as we sort our behavior out, we'll be fine. But if you have these fractures in your foundation, and we're talking about somebody like Gray, who certainly has these predispositions, I believe, for malevolence, then this is going to exacerbate those issues significantly. And apparently, after he takes drugs and gets engaged in that dependency, he becomes a drifter, he's very anchorless, and he starts to drop in his level of hygiene. So if we think about mental health issues, often people who are suffering from significant depression or other more serious concerns, such as dealing with an incident of psychosis, there'll be points of time where often the hygiene will decline because they're not energized in a way that makes them want to take care of themselves. Their self-esteem is really low, or they aren't necessarily computing reality in the way that you and I would be. And so understandably, that affects the way that they present. So it could be that he's starting to feel depressed. And there does seem to be some evidence that Sean Gray was an individual who did suffer at times from depressive moods. Now, in 1995, he graduates from River Valley High School. And people who knew him there said that he was always somebody who was relatively dysfunctional. So behaviorally, he was problematic. Even though he had quite a positive demeanor to a lot of people, there was always an edge to him. And that makes sense because when you look at his history of criminal behavior, it's long. So his first adult arrest, that came just 14 weeks after his 18th birthday. He was still actually at school at the time. And the police report that was filed said that his girlfriend had basically been trying to get out of a relationship for 6 months, which is staggering, isn't it? He's 18. And even at this point, he's so controlling in a relationship that the girlfriend, who's been trying to exit the relationship for 6 months, hasn't found a way out of it. So she's really struggling. The potential that he's one of those individuals who likes to get things his way. Now, in 1996, the same girlfriend reports another domestic incident. She'd actually had a child with Great by then. And in 1996, he was also convicted on burglary in Marion County. At this point, he's sentenced to 4 years in prison. Now, in 1997, his request for judicial release was granted and his sentence was commuted to 5 years of community control. So he was given early release 7 months later. In 1999, this is when Gray was 22, we see an escalation, an uptick in his violence. And this is unsurprising, particularly if somebody has acted inappropriately, been caught by the police, charged, sent to prison, and then released very early on because the consequences are not very present. So therefore, it hasn't tempered the behavior in any way, shape, or form. And also, it doesn't seem that he was privy to any kind of counseling at this point to manage his issues. So at this point, he's 22. He's got a 17-year-old girlfriend now, which again, personally, I think is a little bit questionable. At 17, you are very different to who you'll be at 22. And again, it puts him in the power dynamic at the head of the relationship. He knows a lot more. He's been through a lot more. She's 17. She's probably quite naive. At this point, she is also 2 months pregnant with his child. And she tells the authorities that he basically choked her until she almost passed out. Now, that is a high-level choking. We appreciate that in paraphilias, BDSM is a particular type of sexual connection where people like to be sadistic and masochistic in their behavior towards one another. But this is non-voluntary. This is not a person who's enjoying this situation. So this is violence. And also, if you are choking someone out until they almost pass out, you have the potential to kill them. It's as simple as that. Now, at this point, Great pled guilty to one count of abduction. He was sentenced to 5 years of community control in Marion County, even though he'd already been under this kind of sentence, and it obviously hadn't worked because he's reoffending again. Is it just me who feels it defies logic and reality when we have repeat offenders escalating in their violence and getting the same kind of light sentencing that makes absolutely no difference in the long term. And at that point, he'd also been charged with a second count of abduction and child endangerment, but those charges were dropped. By the way, in that entire event, he spent less than 1 month in jail. Less than 1 month. Now, understandably, the girl's family were devastated by this, so they sought a restraining order, but she then asked the judge to remove the order a few months later. We often see individuals who live with violent perpetrators or in relationships with violent perpetrators are coerced by that perpetrator to believe that they just lost their mind, it will never happen again, and often they will remove things like restraining orders because they believe the best in the partner that they're with. Bear in mind, she was pregnant. She was probably hoping to God he was going to change. Now, the same year, birth records show that Great had a son that was on September the 12th, and a month after the child's birth, Great actually approached the child's mum and her sister with a butcher knife. It's unbelievable that this guy was getting these kind of orders where he had access to the very victims who needed protecting from him. Now, bear in mind, his ex-girlfriend actually sustained a really severe cut to her finger. So I'm not saying he went with the intention to kill them, although certainly if you go armed with a knife, that could certainly be the potential outcome. But the very fact that she gets cut really badly suggests that he's waving it about and she's kind of trying to defend herself. Now, that incident did lead to Great's longest stint of incarceration because he had to go and serve his original 4-year sentence. So that was in 2000, his early release was revoked. He went back to do that. He ends up getting released in January 2003. By October of that very same year, he again gets into trouble with an ex-girlfriend. So she accused him of yet again another choking incident where he choked her and also forced her to perform a sex act on him. He gets at this point charged with 2 counts of misdemeanor domestic violence, which is wrong. He sexually violated her. Why are we not charging him with a much more serious count here? He ends up returning to prison for 7 months. He's then released in May 2004. So he has been in and out. He's also repeated his offences, and we can all acknowledge they're amplifying and escalating in nature. Also, when we look at research on violent perpetrators, particularly violent perpetrators in the sexual arena, what we know is the more incidents that they are caught for and they are incarcerated, the more likely they move towards killing their victims in the long term. If they're not kept off the streets, they realize that the last thing that they need is a witness, because a witness is going to put them back where they don't want to go. Being a sex offender in prison isn't a nice place or space anyway. So ultimately, they make decisions where they don't let the victims ever talk again. So this is a very dangerous territory that we're seeing where Great is concerned. Now, for the next several years, records actually show that Great was only involved in minor issues with the law. It doesn't mean that he wasn't committing illegal activities, but he wasn't getting caught for them. Now, in 2005, so after he's been released from prison, he meets a girl called Christina Hildreth. She was his girlfriend, in fact, for the next 5 years. Now, when she's been asked about their relationship, she said that the main issue with the way that he was in the relationship with her was he was very mentally abusive. And that happened from the very get-go. She said there were incidents of physical violence, but what really underscored the agony of her relationship with him was the fact that he was just really malevolent in the control of her. Now, in 2010, Christina told officers that she'd been assaulted by Great. She actually said he'd hit her multiple times in the face. She'd also been grabbed by the throat. Also, part of her hand had been fractured. So this is a high-level attack. He's then sentenced to 180 days in jail. This is for first-degree misdemeanor domestic violence. She then leaves him after that June event. And on reflection, she truly believes that that saved her life. I think she's absolutely correct. And you will believe the same when I get to the end of this video, because this guy is a danger to all women, irrespective of who you are, where you come from, what your chronology is. This guy is an absolute danger. Now, in 2011, this is in a place called Mansfield, he apparently helped another suspect get away with shoplifting at Dollar General on Lexington Avenue. So he's noted at this point to apparently be helping people get away with criminal impact. And that shows you again that he's somebody who doesn't really apply the morals and the boundaries of civilized society, shall we say. In 2011 again, he ends up marrying somebody called Amber Moman. Now, they meet at church, and she actually said that when she met him, she found him to be this really loving, really kind, really attentive companion. And you know what? He looked okay. He was one of those individuals that when you have that bias of security in life and you think, well, if it looks good, it must be good. And we do that. We are hardwired, in fact, pretty much from the get-go. When we are born, we have to make very quick decisions about what is good for us, what is not good for us. And we can see that really early on, even with babies, when we have done research where pretty people are smiling at the baby versus, shall we say, less societally beautiful people doing the same. And the child is much more attentive to the pretty person, the nice smiley person who looks really attractive. Because in nature, there's that shortcut. Well, it looks good, it must be good. Same as I always say on this channel, if you get a really bruised apple that looks a bit done in, even if it's organically grown and really fantastic for you, and it's placed next to a bright red, shiny, looks like it's straight out of some kind of Disney movie apple, and that's placed next to it, most people will go for the one that looks gorgeous. Not because it's good for us, because it looks like it must be, even though beneath it, there are problems. In this case, massively hydroponically grown, lots of chemicals involved. So too, when you look at this man, your bias of security goes, he doesn't look like he could be really violent. He looks like a nice guy. Bear in mind, Amber Bowman meets him at church. So he's wearing the mask of social acceptability. He's seeming to be a religious guy. Of course, she thinks he's peaches and cream when they connect. But the relationship, just as we've seen in his past relationships, changes and changes quickly. And I would track back, basically, the beginnings of this resentment towards women within his relationship with his mother. I genuinely feel that he sees his mother as somebody who has flouted what he considers the appropriate moral obligations for a female, particularly a mother, and therefore every single woman that he has a relationship to, he feels entitled to treat badly because he believes at their root core, they are bad. And he is trying to seek that out within all the relationships. I'm not excusing it, by the way, quite the contrary. I'm saying there is something within him on a predisposition level that is malevolent. The relationship with his mother is an activator, and the projection of his feelings of rage and resentment towards her are thrown at these innocent individuals who end up sadly in relationships with him. So she said, after that initial honeymoon period, he really works hard to isolate her from her family. Now that's coercive control. I've already talked about the previous individual in a relationship with him who said, look, he was very controlling emotionally. He was manipulative mentally. So this is his main MO. He's taking away from the structures of support, the foundations that can make her safe. And that's what coercive controllers and domestic abusers do. They want you on your own. They don't want you having contact with people who can see the bruises or can see the fact that your self-esteem has just completely disappeared, that realize that there is something really bad happening to you. He doesn't want that. So she's going through this ultimate isolation. Also, he would then disappear from their family home at really odd hours of the day and night. So she doesn't really know where he is, but it causes her concern. There was also an incident where he put his hands around her neck. And she said that when he did that, she looked into his eyes and they just changed. And we...
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Hear that from victims very often, that when they look into the person who's attacking them's eyes, there's almost a blackness that comes over them. They don't seem like the person they were moments before. Understandably, and thank the Lord for the good grace of the decision making of this woman, they end up getting divorced just 1 year later. They do have a daughter together, But nonetheless, she gets away from this horribly toxic relationship. And since their divorce, they'd remained estranged. So this is a man as well, bear in mind, who's going around fathering children and not actually having the good grace to be present in their lives. So there is not a lot of responsibility where Gray is concerned. And that plays in as well to what I would say about his lack of responsibility and accountability as a human being, not just towards his own life, but towards the lives of those individuals that he harms and those individuals whose lives he eventually and ultimately steals. Now, in 2013, his ex-wife reported having these really threatening calls from Gray. And the police report actually said that Gray had made the calls because he hadn't been given any financial support since their divorce. Now, I know what some of you are thinking right now. Well, Emma, that would make sense. If he's got the child, at the end of the day, he is entitled to some kind of spousal support. I mean, you're bringing up your baby, you absolutely deserve some financial help from your ex. Except he didn't have the child. In fact, Amber had custody of the child, and also he didn't visit. Could you imagine that? Sorry, what am I going to court for? Yeah, you're going to court because your ex says that you need to support him. Why? Well, you have a child together. Yes, I know, I'm bringing the child up. I'm paying all the bills. I get nothing off him. Yes, well, he thinks that's grossly unfair and you should pay him so that he can live his life without any of those responsibilities and just crack on. Are you up for that? I'm his lawyer, so I've got to ask. I'm just going to back away slowly now and go and spend some time in a quiet room figuring out how on earth I ever found that absolute not right attractive in the first place. But what does that tell you about this individual? He's not got any visitation to the child. There's no reason for her to actually support him, but he's trying to get cash out of her. And also, he's been horribly violent. He deserves nothing from her. She ended up filing a restraining order against him in August 2013. And he was actually in the same year charged with theft, receiving stolen property and for possession of marijuana. And this was after a call had been made reporting suspicious behaviour involving Gray. So he's back completely in the sights of the authorities. Like I said, repeat offender, and I would say again escalating in his offending behaviour. He also gets charged in April 2014, so not long after, with criminal mischief. Apparently he wrote the word cheese in a woman's window. I will be honest, out of all of the offending, that's the one that worries me least. But I'm throwing it in because I'm going through all of his offending behaviour, and writing cheese in a woman's window probably doesn't suggest that there is something malevolent in that moment, but it does suggest that he has awful boundaries. Or he really likes cheese. I don't know. Or maybe she really likes cheese. Anyway, it didn't go down well, even though it wasn't the most serious offence. The point is, writing cheese in that window got him done for mischief. I like the word criminal mischief. You kind of get it. It's not really, really bad, but it's still a bit bad. Between July 2014 and February 2015, you won't be surprised to know that records show that Gray violated probation 4 times. Why is this guy walking the streets? It's unreal. We get to February 2015. At this point, there's a theft incident. Allegedly, Gray stole jewellery from a woman, and the police reported at the time that this was in fact Gray's girlfriend that he'd taken the jewellery from. Understandably, it could be that he wanted to pawn that for drugs. He obviously has issues with dependency and alcohol. Now, when that same woman was contacted later, she actually denied knowing Gray. So, understandably, that's a problem for moving forward with any case. And in 2015, his Facebook profile actually indicated that he then started work at Mansfield's Holiday Inn as a maintenance man. So even though he's had this prolific background of offending, even though we are seeing really deeply problematic behaviour in this individual, he still ended up getting a job as a maintenance man. And I suppose some people might say, well, maybe he actually wanted to get his life together at this point, but who knows? Now, when it comes down to where he used to live, because we need to look at this because of how the case is going to go. From 2012 to March 2016, he was listed at living at 165 Cliffbrook Drive. But since June 2016, it was believed that Great was actually homeless. So his life is basically spiraled to a point where he is no longer a person with a specific abode and a specific address. So let's go back to where we began with this story. Let's go back after going through that background of who Great is to the 13th of September 2016. This is when those three police officers are dispatched to the address that you heard on the 911 call. It was challenging, first of all. It was difficult for them to find her. They circled the buildings that the victim had described a couple of times. They looked into the windows and they genuinely couldn't see anybody in the home. So they were actually terrifyingly preparing to go back to their cars when one of the officers retried one of the doors at the back of the home. And there was a woman's hand pressed flat against the window pane of the door. Isn't that terrifying? That's straight out of a horror movie, isn't it? The fact that she's got her hand pressed flat against the window pane. The fact that they were about to leave. How harrowing is that? Now, bear in mind, when they arrived, I think that the police genuinely didn't know whether this was some kind of joke, that maybe this was all being made up by somebody. And suddenly they come to their senses and recognise, no, something truly awful is playing out. Now, when they see the woman, she's this slender brunette. She's in her mid to late 30s, and she was identified to investigators as Jane Doe. When they saw her, they knew straight away something dreadful had happened. She was completely nude, and there were extensive bruising on her legs. She also had a restraint hanging from her arm, so they could see everything she had said on that 911 call was 100% true. At this point, officers bust into the abandoned house. This is more than 20 minutes after the victim had called, which is terrifying. If you imagine what could have happened to her if he had come round during that period of time. Now, immediately when they enter the home, what takes their breath away is just the trash. There's dirty clothes everywhere. Also, stuffed animals filled the rooms. They were actually piled to the ceilings. And then inside, amongst all of this, face down on the ground floor bedroom was the abductor that we're talking about, Sean Great. At this point, you can hear the officer shouting, get up, put your hands behind your back. Sean Great, who was described at this point as a homeless individual, he gets arrested at the scene. And understandably, they realise immediately there has been some kind of sexual activity. This man has been forcing this woman into the worst situation possible and that she is 100% a victim. They take Jane Doe at this point to be examined at the University Hospital's Samaritan Medical Centre. That's on the same day, September the 13th. Obviously, it's absolutely imperative that they make sure that they use the rape kit and that they testify that she has endured something horrific so that when it goes to court, that will be given to the jury to hear. The nurse said that she had vaginal injuries. She also had a head injury. She had bruising literally throughout her body. And one of the things that was very obvious to the nurse who actually examined her was that she was just really scared. She was really nervous. She was obviously, as you will have heard in the phone call to 911, very eloquent. She's clearly an intelligent woman. She was able to remain calm, but she's clearly gone through such a stressful and heinous event that now she's safe, one imagines she's going to be very emotional. Another thing that Jane Doe basically told the medical staff was that Great had actually shaved a heart into her pubic hair, and the hospital understandably gave her a razor so that she could get rid of that. Because again, it's that sense of somebody having power over your body, the fact that he'd actually made her do that, and the fact that it's so absolutely contrary to what she's going through, the fact that he's made her put a love heart into her pubic hair, when actually she's the victim of a heinous sexual assault. So he is playing a different game in his head about what this situation is versus what is actually happening, which is a violent sexual rape and violation of the highest level. Now, once he was arrested, because basically he's banged to rights at this point, he was placed in an interrogation room and he was actually interrogated by somebody called Kim Mager. Now, because this particular detective was very schooled in these kind of offences, she's looking for everything when he walks in, not just what he's saying, but how he looks. And Mager immediately notices that this guy is really physically fit. She also noticed that on a hygiene level, it looked like he hadn't showered. But one of the things that really stood out to her was he had these really piercing blue eyes. She was very effective at building rapport. She's very good at getting him to believe that he can trust her. And because she's effective and schooled in this way, he actually starts to speak to her. And he starts to tell her about the fact that he feels that his struggles really began when his mother abandoned him and his older brother when they were 11 and 13 years of age. And I think we can have sympathy and empathy for that. I think we're all aware of the fact that secure attachment is so powerfully important in relationships with those that are our primary caregivers. And when they fail, when they're fractured, it can leave us with some really deep scars. Our expectation as children should be that we can believe our parents are going to be present for us come what may. And when they are not, it makes us question everything, because if they don't love us fully, if they don't wish to protect us fully, if they don't feel we are worthy of their time and presence, then how are we ever to believe that other people who come into our lives who aren't directly related to us are ever going to feel that way? So it can really disable your understanding of secure relationships. He said, I come home from school, then she's gone. But he also said, but I don't blame her. I don't. I used to, but... So I think drawing from that conclusion, we could say, well, maybe you don't blame her anymore, because maybe you found a very malevolent way to practice the resentment that you have by projecting it onto the innocent victims that you harm. Maybe that's how he's managing the rage that he feels towards her. I'm reminded of somebody like Ed Kemper, a case that I've obviously covered on this channel, and how he related to his own mother and the feelings that he had when he became a serial killer about how she had essentially provoked him into a position where he decided to serially kill. Obviously, it's not real. No one can make you into a serial killer. But the resentment and rage is what festered and which eventually erupted into the slayings that he was involved in. And I think that Great probably has a similar level of resentment because of his feelings towards his mother, but he no longer feels it in a directive way towards her because he's found alternative routes to let go of it. Now, in the second hour of interview, he started to open up more about his dysfunctional childhood. He talked about the abandonment and also the abandonment by his father as well, which happened later. He ended up, through this conversation, confessing to the abduction and the rape of Jane Doe, the victim who'd actually rang the police and whose voice you heard on that call. Now, bear in mind, Kim Mager is a dyed-in-the-wool detective, so she is probing. She isn't satisfied that this is just the only crime that this man is involved in that is of such a high level. She feels that there is a strong potential that Great could have been involved in the disappearance, particularly of two other women, a woman called Elizabeth Griffith and Stacey Stanley. Now, Stacey Stanley, she'd actually been missing since Thursday, the 8th of September. She mentioned Elizabeth's name to Great to see what his reaction would be like. And she said it just provoked an immediate response. In fact, he wouldn't look at her. And bear in mind, she'd been interviewing him for a period of time, so she had a benchmark for his normal reactions, but he just wouldn't look at her. And she actually said, hey, look at me. I need your help. I'm not here to judge you. I'm going to ask you for your help. Can you help me? Now, bear in mind, this is what a lot of very effective interrogators do. They make the person who's a heinous excuse for a human being and needs to immediately be sent to some kind of burning hell feel like they don't see that part of them. You'll have seen that if you've watched Chris Watts when he was interrogated. Again, a female interrogator, a female detective, who's basically giving him enough rope to hang himself, saying, you know, I appreciate that you're not a bad guy. Yes, you are. You're a massively bad guy. You're the worst kind of guy in the world. When it comes down to guys, you're at the very, very bottom rung of what a guy could be. Stroke guy, just beneath that demon. So this is what they do. They give them enough rope to hang themselves. Oh, I see the good in you. You've done a terrible thing, but it doesn't make you a terrible person. So she's playing that role. Now, within hours, he goes ahead and he admits to kidnapping Elizabeth Griffith. And he goes further than that. He tells the detective,
prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple, Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N, Rakuten.com.
That she's literally in a closet in the upstairs bedroom of the house that he was arrested in, 132 West 2nd Street. Now, the police at that point were a bit confused. They'd been there, they'd had a look around. They didn't think there was actually a closet in the bedroom. So they had to go back and they had to search the house again. When they get in there, it's a mess. As I said, there's stuff piled up to the ceiling. But one of the things that's notable is all of the windows are shut, so visibility is difficult. They'd all been shaded by bed linens and fabric. People couldn't see in. Officers go up to the upstairs bedroom, and in the centre of that room is this open green fabric sofa bed. Mattress was bare. There were articles of clothing tied to the metal bed frame. Maybe they were used as makeshift restraints. And what they did notice when they're in that room is this really putrid smell. And we all know decomposition smells absolutely putrid. And bear in mind, they've been told they're going to recover a body. So they will without a doubt be thinking he's telling the truth. Now, as they're looking around, they notice that in the room, against the wall, was this really odd-looking wooden pole. It had condoms attached to its tip, and there were also these strange several apparatuses found in other rooms of the house that reflected what they were looking at in that moment. So very odd things that he'd built or put or created in those rooms, usually for sexual purposes, I would imagine. And in the corner of that room, they saw this strange array of clothing. It's hanging from nails stretched from the floor to the ceiling. And again, beneath that, there's this pile of stuffed animals. So officers go about their business looking, where could this closet be? And when they remove the toys and when they remove the clothes, they find a wooden door. And that wooden door has notably been sealed shut with duct tape. So as investigators, they're going to think somebody wants this closed. Somebody wants no one else to see what's in here. So immediately they think they understand what is present in that box. They open the door, and at that point, the smell is absolutely overpowering. And inside that closet was indeed a body. And when they looked, they saw that the top of her head was actually pressed against the back wall. Her legs had been bent slightly upward and her hands were behind her back. But it gets worse. They don't just find one body, they find another. Another body was in the basement of that very same home. On the 16th of September 2016, those two bodies were identified as Stacey Stanley and Elizabeth Griffith. Both women had been strangled, so that developing MO that he'd played out in his relationships where he'd choked his partners out, it's come to fruition fully. He's now murdered these women. Elizabeth Griffith was 29 when she died, just beginning her life. She was struggling. She had issues with her mental health, but people who knew her said that she was one of those people that was always determined to do the right thing, that she always managed to find the joy in the littlest of things. She'd last been seen on the 16th of August. She'd been seen in the area of Ashland Walmart, and then she'd just vanished. 43-year-old Stacey Stanley, she was from Greenwich. She had been described as someone who was down on her luck, but she was somebody who also was remembered fondly for her love of cooking, also her love of family. Now, she had last been seen at the BP station on East Main Street. She'd basically been trying to get her flat tyre fixed. That was just three blocks away from the house that Great was staying in. Now, allegedly, Great had gone up to her and made it seem as though he was going to help her with a flat tyre, but then ultimately he abducted her and he murdered her. He took full advantage of her vulnerability, both in that situation with the fact that she had a flat and also in the situation that she was vulnerable as a human being. Great also went on to confess to Mega the murder of 29-year-old Candice Cunningham. We are talking a serial killer of the highest level when describing Great. Candice was a woman that Great had actually dated. She hadn't been seen since June. She was described by people who knew her as being a really happy, really fun person. She was always giggling. She was somebody who people loved fully. And he had murdered her whilst apparently dating her. He actually took the authorities to a wooded area about 12 miles from Ashland. This is where he had dumped her body, and it was near a burned out house in the Mansfield area. Great also confessed to the murder of 31-year-old Rebecca Lacey. Now, she did have, as many people do with vulnerabilities, an issue with drugs. But people who knew her said, in spite of her dependency issues, in spite of the problems that she endured in life, she was a really loyal friend. She was a good person. She had her problems, but people were devastated to find out what had happened to her. She'd been reported missing in February 2015, and she'd actually been last seen on the 22nd of January. And her body was found on the 16th of March 2015 in a wooded area in Ashland County. Now, initially, when they found her body, it was ruled as a drug overdose by the coroner because the autopsy basically didn't show any signs of traumatic injuries. I think we can all agree as well, when somebody's got a history of dependency, maybe they've got an issue with homelessness, when bodies turn up and the expectation is that maybe they've died of a drug overdose, sometimes the pathologists don't do the same level of thorough investigating of the body as they would when a body turns up, which is completely unexpected. And I'm not saying that was the case. I'm just saying that maybe it influences people's investigation when they think, well, this person has dependency issues, therefore it's likely she died of an overdose. Maybe they aren't doing that diligence in the way that they would if I turned up dead somewhere. Now, Gray actually confessed that his first victim was actually an unidentified woman and that he'd killed her between the years of 2003 to 2006. Doesn't that just tell you something about this man? The fact that he can't even remember when he killed her, that she was so irrelevant to him that he can't compute the date. Now, he actually identified her as Dana, Diane, or Dina. And he basically said, I don't remember when I did it. But he could remember what he did, so he picked her up because apparently he'd recognised her as the person who went around and sold magazine subscriptions. He apparently said that she'd sold a magazine subscription to his mother, but those magazines hadn't been delivered. Whether this is some kind of reasoning behind his logic that he could then go and do a horrible thing to her because the magazines didn't turn up, I don't know. I think there's some kind of loose defense there of his actions, even though that's reprehensible and completely wrong. I do feel he's introducing it for that reason. She was actually later identified as 23-year-old Dana Lowry. She disappeared in 2006, and she was indeed selling magazines at the time. She was also a mother of two. A mother of two. Just going about her business. Just selling magazine subscriptions. Trying to make the best of her life. And he executed her. She was described by people who knew her as a really hard worker who always tried to do the right thing. When they finally found the remains of Dana, they were found in 2007, less than a mile from Great's home. Unfortunately, they could not identify who she was at the time. So he's getting away with this because of these failures. It actually took the SNA evidence combined with Great's confession to finally make a positive ID. So even though they had her body and remains, at least samples of that, it took him admitting what he'd done to link them together so that they could finally bring a level of closure to the family. The interrogation
of great, those initial interviews took 33 hours. That was 8 days in total that he was interviewed over. Kim Mager secured Great's confession to 5 murders, kidnappings, and multiple sexual assaults of women across Ohio. So understandably, Great was indicted on a total of 23 counts on the 22nd of September 2016. These charges were obviously in connection to the murders of Stacey Stanley and Elizabeth Griffin, and also the kidnapping and rape of an unidentified woman who had managed to escape and call for help, which you heard earlier on. One of the things that is pretty profound about this case is what I'm going to tell you shortly, because what Great does whilst he is actually awaiting trial is he's very forthcoming, shall we say, with information. So he actually shows officers in videos with those officers how he managed to murder his victims. So he's just out there, just showing them, I've done all these interviews, I've done my interrogations, I've told you all this information, including names. I'm now going to show you exactly what I did to my victims. So we're obviously all in the same mindset, aren't we? It's a bang to rights, absolutely guilty case. No other way. I mean, he's literally reenacting this with officers of the law. But bizarrely, he pled not guilty to the charges in the September. So he basically said, no, I actually was not in my right mind. I am not actually guilty of these charges in the way that you perceive them and have charged me. Now, bear in mind, this is a little bit weird because he's saying he's not guilty to the charges in the September, but in the October 2016, the same year, after he's obviously gone about reenacting how he murdered people and then said, no, actually, I'm not guilty, he still, a month later, feels that probably the best option for him is to do some interviews from jail about his crimes. So he literally admits to the press that he had killed 5 women. Now, for the prosecution, this is obviously wonderful. If we have somebody who's saying they're not guilty, if we're having somebody pretending that they aren't aware of what they did and so on and so forth, then anything that the prosecution can use against them is a good thing. I genuinely don't know how all this will have come about. You know, can you imagine being his defense, you know, just having a conversation with him? So what we really want you to do is to be aware that because you're saying you're not guilty, yes, I am not guilty. I mean, I'm your defense lawyer. I'm not going to tell people that we all know that you're guilty. No, I'm not guilty. Okay. But I mean, we know you're guilty. But anyway, whatever. We're going to defend you accordingly because that's your right. But what we want to make sure with this not guilty is that you don't do anything that's going to cause any incrimination. You know, they've already got all those admissions in the interrogation. And then there's those like really kind of weird videos that you did where you were enacting exactly how you murdered the victim. So we're like really struggling anyway to get it out there that you are not guilty, because you kind of seem like you've got your marbles about you and you are actually quite eloquent in describing things. So it's kind of difficult for us to push the fact that you're insane. And what we could really do with is you just not making it more difficult and challenging for us. Is that okay? Could you just do that? Just be quiet. Just zip it. Yeah, of course. So you're not going to talk to anybody. You're not going to incriminate yourself. You're not going to give anything out there that could cause us a problem in the case. No, absolutely not. Of course not. Why would I do that? Great. Okay, cool. I'll see you at our next meeting. Pan to lawyer opening newspaper or listening to the news. Okay, so he's literally admitted it to the press. Is there chance that I can get a new job? Is there any chance that anybody could take this case off me? Sorry, could you, husband of mine, could you just, no, you're not going to do it either. I'm just going to go and find a quiet room and cry. I cannot imagine how the defense would have felt, but they had to get this gag order because he just couldn't stop speaking.
She's in your bedroom and you are face to face. She tries to get out of the bedroom. Tell us what happens from there.
I back her out. I turn her around. She comes towards me. I knock her hands around, knocked her whole body around, and just grabbed her like she just was meant to be choked out.
Okay.
I mean, it felt right in my hands.
Okay.
I set her back, laid down, and I actually laid down with her. We was laying down. I'm just side by side.
And is that upstairs or downstairs? At what point did you stab her in the neck? Was she still alive then or not alive?
She woke up.
She woke up from the strangulation?
Downstairs. Downstairs. She woke up downstairs.
So when you took her downstairs, did you take her down thinking she was dead?
No. No, because I knew before. That was just a little temporary, like a pass out.
Okay.
We were dealing with friends and playing around pass out games.
So you went downstairs, and then what happened? She woke up.
Yeah, panicked. I didn't know what to do. I ran upstairs, grabbed a knife, kitchen. You know, the first thing I did when I went downstairs, stabbed her in the neck. I didn't know what to do.
And you said the knife was a serrated knife or a straight blade knife?
I believe it was a straight knife. It was like a knife you cut onions with.
Okay.
Now, in late April 2018, he goes on trial for the murders of Elizabeth Griffith and Stacey Stanley, as well as the assault of the woman who you heard in the phone call, who's known as Jane Doe in this case. The prosecution at this point go through the 23-count felony indictment. And at the very beginning of the opening statement, prosecutor Chris Tunnell said, "The defendant confessed to every crime with which he is charged. This isn't a whodunit case," Tunnell told the jury in his opening statements. "This is a he done it case." I do like what he did there. I think me and Mr. Tunnell get on very, very well. It isn't a who done it case. It's a he done it case. And he understandably goes through what happened, beginning with Great's arrival in Ashland County in June 2016. Tunnell said that Great initially was breaking into and living in campers in Charles Mill and basically later constructed what was known as a fort in the woods near Mifflin before coming up to the city of Ashland and living in a vacant house at 363 Covert Court. This house is where the woman called 911 and also where the two bodies were found. But he's obviously moving around. There's a transience to his nature. Now, the woman who called 911, bear in mind, she'd been restrained on the bed and repeatedly raped over the span of 2 days. She escaped, as we know, when she was on the phone to 911 whilst he was asleep. Now, Tunnell also talked about how Great had met Elizabeth Griffith and Stacey Stanley, who Great was accused of kidnapping and strangling to death. He actually told the jury of the harrowing reality that Great had videoed himself raping Jane Doe and Stacey Stanley, and that was going to be shown to the jury. Because bear in mind, this guy's gone not guilty. So the jury have to witness this harrowing evidence. Several hours of interview footage was also going to be shown to the jury. And at this point, Great's attorneys actually waived their opening argument after Tunnell concluded his, because there isn't one, is there? I mean, it's going to be really difficult to actually have a decent opening statement when this guy is as dead to rights, as bang to rights as he could ever possibly be. So they don't actually give an opening argument. Now, the prosecutors alleged that Great held Jane Doe, the woman who'd rung the police, that led eventually to Great's arrest, from the 11th to the 13th of September. He said he held her captive from the night of the 11th of September, which was a Sunday.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Day until the 13th of September, the Tuesday morning. They told the jury that he beat, that he raped Jane Doe repeatedly in that time. She, with the courage of an absolute warrior, took the stand. She was on that stand for 2 hours. Throughout her testimony, she didn't even once look in Great's direction. I understand that completely. How re-traumatizing to look in the eyes of a man who put you through such trauma. She said that she'd actually met him at the Croc Center in Ashland in the summer of 2016. She said that they would have lunch together. They'd have lunch a couple of times a week. That they would go on long walks together. That she liked him. She said that they would discuss the Bible. They'd talk about life. They'd actually sometimes play tennis together at Brookside Park. So to all intents and purposes, he came across as a completely typical human being. Somebody a little bit quirky, maybe a little bit eccentric, but nothing notable to cause concern. She then talked about the fact that he made her aware that he would like, shall we say, more than just an ordinary friendship with her, but that wasn't something that she wanted to pursue. One of the things that she talked about was that she was not a believer in premarital sex. She said it was a no-no. So she didn't ever let him go into her apartment because she didn't want to give him any false ideas about where the relationship was going. And she had very specific morals when it came down to any kind of premarital sex. Now, he had been to her apartment, but she'd never actually let him in. She said in court, "I have boundaries. I don't let guys in my place. It's just not a good idea." She wouldn't even exchange phone numbers with Great. Now, she said, while that friendship was developing, he respected those decisions. So she is with a guy who is apparently respecting her boundaries. She's hanging out with him regularly and she feels comfortable with him. She has no idea of this serial killer that she is literally spending time with, nor does she have any inclination of what he is intending to do to her. So once he's gained her trust, once she believes that she is safe with him, she is invited back to his home. She'd been to that house a couple of times. She said one of the things that she did notice when she went there the second time was it was really dirty. And she said that felt very atypical because he was usually somebody, as far as she was concerned, who seemed to be very clean. He looked after himself. Now, people in the past have said his personal hygiene was bad, and also officers who arrested him said that it was bad. But it's very clear that when he was seeing her, he's going to have this mask of acceptability, and so he's probably tended to his appearance on those occasions. Again, he's masking the monster belief. She said on that day, they walked to Mifflin to see his fort because he built this fort in the woods, and she said it was pretty cool looking. And at that point, he ends up giving her a box of gems when she's there. So he's gifting her these things. So she's probably thinking this is quite sweet. Again, nothing too scary that makes her feel on the back foot. Now on September the 11th, they end up going for a walk. At this point, they stop at the Dollar Tree because she needed cleaning supplies. At this point, they get a ride from a friend, somebody called Tamara Whelan. They go back to her place. She ends up making them peanut butter sandwiches. He eats his outside. Again, a totally ordinary day. At this point, Great tells Doe that he's got this bag of clothes that have apparently come from his mother and sister. They want to give these clothes to her. He also says, "Have you got a spare Bible?" So he's really building her up into this point where she feels that she's got to go with him, particularly when it's the Bible situation. She's a woman of God. Of course, she wants to spread the word. And also there's a gift for her. So she goes along with him back to his place. She's been there twice before, as I've said. Why would she be afraid? She voluntarily enters that house. And at this point, she's reading Bible passages. She's actually using the Bible to spread the word with him. Great then goes to the kitchen. When he comes back, it's all changed. So basically, that cloud that we've heard about before, reported by exes, when his eyes go black, that's what occurs. He's got her fundamentally home, and now the predator has his prey. She said at this point, he starts pulling the Bible out of her hand. She said, "I looked up at him, and that's when he said, 'You are not going anywhere.'" And she knows straight away something terrible is going to happen. She said she tried to push him away. She said, "I tried to kick, punch, but everything I did, he just did it so much harder. This guy's big, he's strong, he's tall, she's a slight female, she has no hope in fighting this man to a point where she can escape. She said she continued to fight, but then he starts to choke her. And she knows at this point, if she fights any harder, she's not going to be able to get out of it, and maybe she won't get away with her life. She said on that first night, this woman, who wouldn't even let him across her boundary of her apartment because she does not believe in those kind of relationships with men before marriage, this woman who had saved herself, this woman who had really practiced what she preached, what she believed, she said that she was sexually assaulted by Great in every way imaginable. She talked to the court, having to be open about the horror and trauma she endured, telling them he tied her up at least 3 times in weird positions or to the bed. She said at one point he put a restraint around her neck and he said that if she moved, she'd strangle herself. She said she was literally continually assaulted and raped while she was awake. She said that when she woke up on the 13th of September, she noticed he was asleep and she was terrified, but she knew that there was a potential that maybe, just maybe, God would be on her side and she could escape. She said that she was working on trying to get the shackles unbound and she was just praying and praying and praying, just asking God for that intervention. And suddenly she managed to free herself enough so she could get Great's phone and so she could call 911 from across the bedroom, the call that you heard. She said that whilst she's on the phone, one of the things that was harrowing for her was that she accidentally set off a taser. At that point, he sits up, puts his feet down on the floor. She said he was really groggy. He looked like he was going to wake up, but then he just sits there for what seems like 30 seconds. But then he laid back down again. Imagine the panic, the fear, the psychological horror of seeing this man, your captor, your predator, come round. To know that ultimately that could be the end of your life, potentially, if he sees that you have freed yourself. But ultimately, he goes back into that sleeping stupor. In court, they played the interview between Ashland Police Detective Kurt Dorsey and Sean Great from when he was first arrested. At this point, Great had actually told the officer he had been staying at 363 Covert Court, which was a vacant house. He'd been staying there apparently for about a month. He told that officer he'd been living in a makeshift fort also in the woods near Mifflin, and he said that he'd actually watched the 4th of July fireworks from there. Great told Dorsey that he and Jane Doe had actually been discussing marriage. Now, of course, this is a complete opposite reality of what Jane Doe is telling the testimony in court and originally when she spoke to investigators. She's clearly a victim of horrendous rape. But he's painting this picture of, no, no, we've got this great relationship. We were going to get married. He even said, I did one little thing. So he's basically saying, I didn't really do anything wrong, just one little thing. He said, we have a good relationship. Had. I guess it's all up to her now. As if there is some kind of bridge to cross where they can get back together. It's ludicrous. But he's painting himself as in a relationship with her at that first arrest scenario. Now, Dorsey, at this point, pressed Great to tell him what had happened the previous night. He said, a nightmare. Great said he lost control and that the situation, quote, got out of hand. He then also asked if Jane Doe was actually okay. Great told the officer that they'd had sex. He said, I thought it was mutual. He then said she started flipping out. No, she didn't start flipping out at all. That's a massive lie. She was absolutely terrified. She fought for her life. She was overpowered. And then when he was unconscious, she managed to escape. But he's trying to paint the picture of consensual sex. Now, when it came to the other individuals that he was accused of killing in court, he said that he met Elizabeth Griffith at a shopping centre. He again painted this picture of friendship, that they just hang out, they play games, apparently mostly Yahtzee. This is who he told to a television producer about the relationship. He said, the short time I talked to her, she cried several times just about life, how she couldn't find anybody to love her. This was in a Cleveland 19 interview where he was giving this information to the press. He said, all I wanted to do was to show her that she wanted to live. And I'd say, give me a hug, we're all in this together. And I'd choke her until she said she wanted to live and she just didn't. I kid you not. So basically this guy isn't a really terrible human being. This guy isn't just a serial killer. He's actually just a victim of circumstance. He's trying to be a good guy. Just compute that in your brain, seriously. He's telling the interviewer, well, I'm really this nice friend. Yeah, tell me about why you're this nice friend. I'm this nice friend because when I'm hanging out with people who are unhappy, a bit depressed, they're not finding their way forward in life easy, I'm like, we should do something fun, like games. Okay, so something I can see could be mindful, playing games. Yeah, Yahtzee. We played Yahtzee together. Well, that's quite commendable. Yeah, yeah. But you must have done other things to being caught accused of a murder. Well, okay, yeah. I mean, I get where you're going with that. But I would say that you could position me as a killer. Is that because you killed her? Yes, that is because I killed her. But on another hand, did I kill her? Well, I think you did. I think you've admitted you killed her. Well, just let's go through this. She said she wanted somebody to be there for her, so I hugged her a lot. Okay, again, that's quite commendable. Exactly. Just go with me on this. But then she said that she didn't want to live. So I was like, well, okay, I will choke you to a point where you realize you do want to live. And she would say, oh, I want to live, because I was choking her. That doesn't sound like a really appropriate way to manage the situation. That sounds very violent. No, I'm just helping her to understand that she does want to live. Except for on one occasion, she didn't say she did. So I just carried on and ultimately killed her. So am I a bad person? Or am I somebody who just tried to help? I'm going to go down the route of really, really, really bad person. But this is what he says. Bizarre. So somehow, he's not the heinous human being we're talking about. He's somebody who was just trying to help somebody out. Now, after he strangled this poor victim, he took her key, he went to her apartment, he took shampoo and paper towels, so he stole from her. And then Stacey Hicks, another one of his victims, this is a girl who also went by the name Stacey Stanley. She had been literally battling to stay off heroin for the 6 months before she disappeared on September the 8th. So she was really trying to get her life together. And witnesses testified that they saw Hicks and Great together at a gas station on the day that she vanished. And a video was actually shown in court of Great with Stacey. And in one of these videos, he seemed to be standing over Stacey. And she's saying, you told me I could leave. So she's obviously in a scenario where she's scared. And she thought that things were going to be okay and that he'd let her go. And he isn't letting her go. And at one point, that video goes black. And there's clearly an audible struggle. And Great's face couldn't be seen in the video. But an officer testified he was absolutely confident it was Great in the video. So he's literally videoing the demise of these victims, and he's doing that for his sadistic pleasure. It's a memento video. It means you can relive it again and again and again. You probably won't be surprised that partway through the trial, Great decided to plead guilty to 15 of the 23 charges. Now, don't get me wrong, the pleas didn't include the murder or the kidnapping charges. But what he did plead guilty to was 4 counts of rape, 2 counts of gross abuse of a corpse, tampering with evidence, unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, kidnapping, robbery, 4 counts of burglary, and a charge of breaking and entering. So he didn't take responsibility for the murders and not all the kidnappings, but he did take responsibility for some of the charges. Now, in the closing statements, prosecutor Chris Tunnell began by replaying those audio tapes of Great being questioned by investigators, and also at the same time showing the jury pictures of those poor victims' bodies that had been found in the address that Great had been staying. In those audio recordings, Great actually said he would, quote, use his victims and make it so they, quote, won't have to cry anymore. How minimizing is he in this? He would use his victims, but then he would basically put them out of their misery. Tunnell then, in his closing argument, said this is not a spur-of-the-moment killing. Take a broad view of the evidence. What do you know, this victim? Listen to what he says. Look at what he did. The defense, of course, well, they asked the jury to consider whether there was any premeditation involved in the killings, but they also noted that Great would be held accountable regardlessly, they knew that he wasn't going to walk out a free man. They were more inclined to go with the, is this actually a premeditated killing or was this just something that he did in the moment? I think we can all agree it was a highly premeditated killing. And with respect, just looking at the way that he treated his final victim, Jane Doe, that was planned and cultivated over a period of time before he got her back to his property, or the one that he was at least staying in, and put her through the most horrendous ordeal of violent sexual behaviour and violation. And the likelihood is she would have been murdered too if she hadn't got away. Just like...
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
With the other victims, where he was playing Yahtzee and trying to be nice to her to a point where he got her trust, and then he murdered her, and so on and so forth. This is the way he operates. Of course, it's premeditated. On the 14th of May, after the jury deliberated for 3 hours, the jury found Sean Great guilty of 8 counts. That included the 2 murders and the sexual assault and kidnapping of Jane Doe. The jury recommended the death sentence. As the verdict was read out to the court, Great showed very few signs of emotion because, let's be honest, he has the emotional vocabulary of a rock, a very, very big rock. Less use than a rock, though. Rocks can actually be helpful for things like paperweights. This man has got absolutely no use within his being whatsoever. Well, I mean, we could think about some experimental use for him, but I don't think ethically or morally that would be allowed in the courts. But he did occasionally hang his head. Aside from that, no accountability, no responsibility at this point. Now, during his sentencing for the Ashland County crimes in 2019, 11 people actually went ahead and addressed the court, and Great, they gave really powerful victim impact statements. And as I said, in 2019, he was given the death sentence. So this guy, at some point, is going to lose his life. When that announcement happened, shortly before 11:30 a.m., the crowd in the packed courtroom broke out in applause. They were celebrating. They absolutely believed that the death sentence was 100% appropriate. He was also, on top of that, sentenced to a minimum of 90 years to life in prison for other charges, and he is in fact due to be executed on the 19th of March 2025. The prosecutor said that there has actually been, and it's very hard to draw any positives out of what I've talked about today, but they said that something positive has emerged from the sadness. He said that the community has really rallied around and that the Ashland residents are now more vigilant. He said there's an increased awareness that the troubles of the world can come to Ashland, and that's made people more vigilant and also more aware of those people that can obviously slip through the net, times that we have to as a society prevent from slipping through the net. Outside the courthouse, when it was announced, loved ones from both families gathered on the steps and they had purple and yellow balloons. They wanted it to be noted that, yes, they were happy that this result had occurred, but they also wanted to remember the people who that they had lost. In September 2018, Great actually appeared in court in Richland Court as well, because bear in mind, he hadn't been tried for all of the offences. So included in those charges are counts of aggravated murder, kidnapping, tampering with evidence, and gross abuse of a corpse. So he pled guilty to aggravated murder and gross abuse of a corpse in the death of Rebecca Lacey. and also murder and gross abuse of a corpse in the death of Candace Cunningham. That was in exchange for pleas of 10 other charges being dismissed. So Judge Brent Robinson sentenced Great to life in prison without parole for the aggravated murder of Rebecca and 17 years to life for the other three charges, and made those sentences run consecutively. And obviously he's not getting out anyway, because we all know he's going to be put to death. Now, in September 2019, Great pled guilty to the murder of Dana Lowry in Marion County. Great entered guilty pleas to charges of aggravated murder, kidnapping, abuse of a corpse, and tampering with evidence. As with his other victims, Great is believed to have strangled Dana at some point in May 2006. He was actually sentenced to life in prison without parole for the 2006 murder, but let's be honest, he's got the death penalty, so at some point he's going to be taking his last breath in prison, and I have no doubt the families of his victims will be present when that happens. Now, when he was given an opportunity to speak, he did actually say he was sorry for what he did. He said, "I wish I would have done this a long time ago, back in 2006. Great said, "I apologise to everyone for this, for what I've done, the shame." So basically he's saying he feels really bad about what he did and he wished he'd admitted it all those years ago.
"You know, I don't know exactly, you know, I can't say I'm normal, but, you know, I know right from wrong. And mainly, just if I cause any hate, bitterness, and then all of any of this, you can work on that. I ask you maybe forgive me. Find in your heart someday. I know not today, but someday. Just move on from this life. And may justice be served today. That's most important. Elizabeth, Stacy, and Lori, thank you for all your time. This mess, I'm sorry for all human beings that have to hear this. Okay? Sorry. Can't change nothing. We never would."
I think we can all agree he's a massive liar. As we all know serial killers are, it's part of their makeup. They can't help themselves. The idea that it's like, "Oh, you know, on reflection, I wish I'd just come clean in 2006. I'm not really a bad person. I just really wanted to play Yahtzee with people and I was just loving people to their death." It just beggars belief. Now, the press dubbed Great the Lady Killer, and they did that because of his apparent looks and charm. I don't know where the press go with these things. This guy didn't wash. Just gonna throw it out there. He didn't wash. He had a penchant for storing cuddly animal toys and piling them up in a hoarded kind of way in places that he spent time. He built a fort because he wanted to in the woods. I'm just gonna throw it out there. If a guy was like, "I want to show you my etchings," and then I went somewhere and he actually showed me his etchings were stuffed animals piled up to the ceiling and he didn't wash and he had a fort in the woods, I would be like, "I'm going to back out slowly and move to another state." But the press like to dub these kind of names and give them monikers they don't deserve. And yeah, this guy wasn't a heinous looking human being that you look at and think, "I'm going to run 5 miles because he scares me just with his face." This guy looked average. But the idea that he was some charming individual who was really good looking, I just don't buy into it. I mean, maybe on the scale of serial killers, he's better looking than an average one. But to me, what you see about his makeup, his predatory behavior, his treatment of women in the past, how is that charming? There is nothing charming about this man. Now, interestingly, Great's mother, a woman called Teresa McFarland, who, as I said, abandoned him, she actually granted one interview to the Daily Mail. And it was quite scathing, I think we can agree. She said that her son's charm was evident from his early years. She said, "He's good looking, but the devil's good looking too." Is he? Sorry, guys, I'm going to give you this quote properly, but I just want to question whether that's true. I personally, when I think about the devil, I think horns, long chin, usually red. You know, that's the way I see him. Big, strong thighs, animal kind of makeup, arms and legs. Terrifying. I don't think about the devil and go, "Oh, yeah,
that kind of red horned creature is right up my street. I don't know whether she's saying something about herself here. Maybe she has a really strange taste in men. I don't think the devil's ever been good looking, but apparently, I'm going to go back to the beginning of the quote. She feels that this is the case. He's good looking, but the devil's good looking too. He ain't no red horns and all that stuff. So again, I'm just going to have to stop. She does acknowledge that the devil has red horns. I don't get it. Teresa, you maybe need to have a question about the levels of attraction that you have to men and why your relationships may not have worked out. But anyway, he ain't no red horns and all that stuff. You find out he's charming. And of course, that charm can charm the pants off anybody. Not to be nasty, but you just know how it works. Well, I'm just going to again throw it out there. It wasn't his charm that got the pants off anybody. It was the fact that he's a malevolent, sadistic rapist and murderer. There was not any coercion in a positive way, as in, oh, let's go out and have a meal. Let's enjoy being together and get intimate. There wasn't any of that kind of acceptable manipulation that people play in relationships where they're attracted and want consensual sex. This was very, very different. This man didn't charm anybody. He had a taser, Teresa. He used things that were weapons to make his victims do his bidding. That's not charm. She also told the reporter that drugs in prison changed her son, and she did note that the family had indeed been estranged from him. Great is currently serving out his sentence in Chillicothe Prison with appeals. It's going to be, as we expect, years before Great could face execution, in spite of the fact it is scheduled for next year. I don't know how you feel about the death penalty, but if anybody deserves it, if morally and ethically it's acceptable in any way, shape or form, my God, Great should have earned the t-shirt where this one is concerned.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.